Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
You're now in the Essential Zone, where we seek to be informative, inspirational, enlightening, and dynamic. But more importantly, we seek to be fair and balanced. There comes a time when the game tolerates no spectators, only players. There comes a time when we must recognize that our individual aspirations shape our collective destiny. There comes a time when getting in the game, despite the risks, despite the challenges, regardless of the cost, is simply the right thing to do. There comes a time when we must find our hearts, find our soul, and pursue our purpose for the greater good of all, for country, for humanity. There comes a time when we must manifest our true greatness. Yes, there comes a time, and that time is now. So let's get down to the essentials. The essentials. Serious radio for serious people committed to advancing the national conversation. And good evening and welcome to Guardian Radio 96.9. I am your host, Hubert Edwards, and welcome to Guardian 96.9 FM. This is The Essentials, The Reset. This evening, we're going to have ourselves a conversation. We're going to talk a lot about some economic issues, some of the things which are plaguing the country at this point in time. We're going to take a look at the newspapers, today's newspaper, today's Guardian, as an example, just going through the headlines themselves, tells a very, very interesting story, weaves a very interesting picture, and gives some very, very important insight as to where we are right now and potentially some of the things that we will need to grapple with over the next couple of months. But of course, we want you to join us. The numbers are 323-6232, 325-4316, 325-4259. And, you know, you can call us with your questions, your comment. Let's have a conversation. This evening show is brought to you by Next Level Solutions. At Next Level Solutions, we help our clients to confront challenges with risk, governance, compliance, operational effectiveness, and strategy. We look for and help to secure practical solutions and help our clients to thrive. And so we want you to join us as a part of this conversation. Now, what is happening in the big world of finance, economic finance, as it relates to the Bahamas? If you are in one of these WhatsApp group, and there are many, many around town, you would see, or you may probably have seen, a document being shared around from Bloomberg, which talks about emerging markets, Club of Distressed Nations gets 4 new members. So each market maker or major entities that report on these matters, they have their listing, usually market makers, so they have their listing of countries, sovereigns. So by sovereign, I mean the Bahamas is a sovereign, Nigeria, Jamaica, Barbados, the United States, and so on and so forth. And they report on these, in this case, emerging markets, so usually developing countries like the Bahamas, like many of the countries in the Caribbean region. And they have this list that they keep of those countries which are considered to be distressed. So by distress, it means that they believe based on objective observation, that the country may struggle to repay its debt. It may be in that position where it could potentially have struggles in repaying its debt. And so I wanted to go through this with you. Most of the information there doesn't relate necessarily to the Bahamas, but just to give an understanding of exactly what is happening out there in the world to create a benchmark and a basis for your comparison and analysis. And so it reads, sovereign bonds of Ecuador, Kenya, Nigeria, and Egypt have begun trading at distressed levels this month as more investors turn sour on emerging markets. Now, none of those three countries, obviously, is the Bahamas. We readily recognize that. It's Ecuador, Kenya, Nigeria, and Egypt. But it says that those four countries have started to trade at distressed levels. And so I want to draw a couple of things to your attention. One, the first is distress level. And what does that mean? And it also goes on to say that investors have turned sour on emerging markets. Emerging markets, as I mentioned to you, is usually developing countries. And for the purpose of our conversation here, what you need to know is that the Bahamas is considered to be an emerging market country. So we are there, and investors have turned sour, as quoted here. So investors are basically asking for more in terms of their investment in emerging markets. Distress levels represent a particular threshold, and I will read this section to you at this time. The number of developing nations with dollar bonds offering a risk premium of at least 1,000 basis points over U.S. Treasuries, a threshold that signals a nation may struggle to repay its debt, jump from 15 to 19 as of Monday. So per Bloomberg, there are now 19 countries, emerging market countries, which are trading at a premium of at least 1,000 basis points. And so that, all of that 1,000 basis points is fancy speak for 10%. 100 basis points is 1%. 1,000 basis points is 10%. And it's trading above that as a premium on U.S. Treasuries. So the question to be asked is, what would be U.S. Treasuries at this point in time? And if you look, you know, Google it, as they say, from two years, 5 years, 10 years, and 20-year bonds or 30-year bonds, Treasury bonds, the top rate is 3.17%. The lower rate for 2 years is 2.91%. So if a particular bond is trading at a premium on those, at the lower end, they would be requiring 12.91% or about 13%. And at the top end, they would be requiring 13.17% or about 13% if you round it down. The Bahamas has found itself in this category, where our debt, U.S. dollar denominated debt, is trading at 13% or more. Sometimes it's 13.5. It fluctuates. But it's above that 10% premium threshold. The thing goes on to say that, they're 19 as of Monday, according to data compiled by Bloomberg. Only 9 nations were in the distressed territory at the end of last year. So 9 to 19, 10 additional ones would have gone in. Heavily indebted countries are feeling the strain of a supply crunch for food and fuels. As a supply crunch for food and fuel stoke inflation and spark recession concerns, driving up their borrowing costs. Losses for emerging markets, sovereign dollar debt have exceeded 19% for this year for investors. So there are investors out there, there are persons who have been investing in the emerging markets and they have suffered losses, 19% or thereabout. Also spooked by the Russia's invasion of Ukraine, pull funds sending average bond yields to almost 8%, the highest level in more than 2 years. I also saw someplace else where we see that riskier yields are now at an average of about 10.6%, which is the highest in about 10 years. The picture I'm trying to paint here for us is this. We are sitting in an environment which is deeply disadvantageous to us as a country at this point in time. I have made this point over and repeatedly, and as I mentioned, I think last week or the week before, there are other persons who have other views. There are other persons who are willing to not underline this particular moment in time as being one of the most important in the economic life of the Bahamas. So I am going out on a limb, yes. I'm taking the risk and I'm saying that it is. This particular budget, I have said before and written elsewhere, is maybe one of the most important budgets in the history of the Bahamas. And not because it is an allocation of revenue and expenditure, which it is. And not because we are projecting revenue for the first time at $2.8 billion, which we are. But largely because I believe, I have concluded, and I'm open to be wrong, that every single aspect of our success, momentum going forward, is going to be highly dependent and subjected to the state, the condition, the circumstances around our national debt. And if that is the case, and if that holds true, then the circumstances which I just described to you puts us in a bit of a spot of bother. Per the most recent budget, the gross financing need for the country stands at about $1.8 billion. And that $1.8 billion is broken up in part in terms of rescheduling, so existing debt which currently on the books, which are maturing and needs to be repaid, but we actually won't repay it. In totality, we will borrow and pay off the old one and create a new one. So there's that rescheduling, but there's also provision which needs to be made of $500+ million in interest costs for the current fiscal, of which I think about $275 million is going to be local. Of the $500+ million, $275 is going to be local and the rest is going to be going out of the country. It's for the foreign portion of our debt. So why is this important? Why do we need to step back and take a very careful and sober look at where we are in terms of our debt situation? Because at the end of the day, here is how I want to reason this out with you. And for the accountants out there, they'll readily recognize this. In accounting, we have a formula which says asset minus liability equal capital. And it's something which it's a formula which you can, solve for different aspects. You can solve for asset, you can solve for liabilities, and you can solve for capital. I think instinctively, if we think about the budget in terms of that formula I just outlined to you, you're likely to say, revenue minus expenditure equals deficit. True. So the total amount of revenue that we expect in or we actually get in minus the total expenditure that we project or that we actually get at the end of the fiscal will determine the level of the deficit. But I just want to remove, for the purpose of this conversation, I just want to remove the word deficit and to say revenue minus expenditure equal debt. Revenue minus expenditure equal debt. Because that's exactly what it is. The debt that we have on the books today is an accumulation of all the deficits. In other words, all of the mini debts that we created over a number of years. So if by our actions, if by financing the operations of government, we are going to be, and we are projected to be, in a position of creating additional debt, then obviously the circumstances in which those or that debt is going to be financed, the environment within which that debt can be financed must be significantly important. Have to be. Because here's what's really happening. When you spend all of the money that you take in, assuming that you spend every single cent, so at a personal level, let's assume that you're making a salary of $12,000 per year, but you have expenses of $15,000, then you have a shortfall of about $3,000, which you are going to fund by getting a loan from one of the local banks. If for any particular reason you approach all of the banks and they say to you, you really can't qualify for this, or we are going to charge you a rate which is at this level because we believe that your credit worthiness is kind of underwater, then obviously, you're going to be in a spot of bother because you won't be able to close that circle on your revenue and your expenditure. So that's really what the government, the administration, is faced with. With a revenue of $2.8 billion, an expenditure of $3.3 billion, there is a deficit of $564 million. And that has to be closed by borrowing. Now, I believe, and, you know, we oftentimes kind of cloud the way we talk about civil servants and the way we talk about governments. Oftentimes, we kind of cloud that in maybe political terms. I don't really have that problem. I feel very comfortable, saying respectfully that I don't agree with that or that is good. But oftentimes we do not give credit where credit is due. And I believe, just based on observation, I don't have any special insight or insider information, but just based on observation of what flows out into the public, it is clear that the Ministry of Finance, the administration generally, but the Ministry of Finance being the entity, the parties which are actually doing the work on the ground, they're working very, very hard. And I must add, very creatively to address some of the issues that we are faced with. But there are two things I want to draw to your attention in that particular statement that I just made. One is that they're working very hard. And two, that they're working very creatively. And you may ask yourself, why does that matter? People should work hard. And it's not a bad thing to work creatively. True. But those two things evidences something else. In my mind, it says to us that the circumstances that they are faced with on a day-to-day basis as they interact with the market and seek to find the source of funding is extremely challenging. Very challenging. The level of creativity that we saw, you know, whether you want to agree or not, but the level of creativity that we saw in the most recent transaction with the IDB helping to provide some guarantee on a particular loan, I don't remember the numbers offhand, but the IDB basically gave a guarantee, I think up to maybe 200,000, 200 million or 250 million, whatsoever the number is. And that guarantee caused the Bahamas to be able to raise the funds that it needed at a rate which is significantly less than its current yield curve. And so we listen to the news media, we read the newspaper, and we would have heard the financial secretary or the minister of economic affairs said, we were able to create this transaction, which is superior. The end result is superior to our yield curve. But oftentimes, nobody will ever stop and ask, well, exactly what is the yield curve level? Because if you're going to make, and they're correct. They're 100% correct. Because the transaction, I think, at the end of the day, work out to be the non-IDB portion work out to be, I think, somewhere about 9.7%. And the other one was down at 2.5%. And when if you put those two transactions together in financing terms, then the overall absolute yield, the effective yield at the end of the day, or the effective cost at the end of the day, is going to be pretty good given the circumstances that we face. But that reality is indicative of what we face for the future. Now, bear in mind that the financing that was done was really part and parcel of what my term, mopping up the remaining obligations of the government for the fiscal year 21-22. If you go back to the paper, it was reported in the Nassau Guardian. I think the indicative rate at the time was expected to be 13.5%. But when they actually went to market, I think they got it down to 9.8. Don't quote me on that number. But it went down significantly, sufficiently to be in a position and to be justifiably so, be able to celebrate the win. It was a win. That particular transaction did a couple of things for the Bahamas because it said to us, and I think provided the government, the administration, with confidence, that following the repo transaction, it was able to go back to market. And being able to access market is, you know, important. It's fundamental. When you have a debt stock of $11 billion, you're looking at a gross borrowing needs of $1.8 billion, and you have U.S. bonds trading at, well, you have U.S. or dollar-denominated bonds trading sometimes as high as 13, 14%, being able to access the market is fundamental to the business of financing the operations of the government. Because unless you can access the market, obviously, you're not going to secure the needs, the funds you need. And so we have to look at all that is happening through that lens. So as I mentioned to you before, the premium that the Bahamas is really paying out at this point in time, or the premium which has been asked for by investors on Bahamian denominated debt is somewhere around 10%, which puts us in an unenviable grouping of countries, with distressed debt. When you take a look at these countries, I am reading them for you. This group from Bloomberg, referred to as the Troubled 10, are Belarus, Ukraine, Maldives, Tajikistan, Pakistan, the Bahamas, Kenya, Ecuador, Nigeria, and Europe. Again, Belarus, Ukraine, Maldives, Tajikistan, Pakistan, Bahamas, Kenya, Ecuador, Nigeria, and Egypt. So we have landed on this list, which is a place we don't want to be. And this turns really around our creditworthiness, or at least as the market sees us to be creditworthy. And so within the context of what we have to do in funding the budget and looking for growth and confronting the high levels of inflation and dealing with the fallout from Russia and Ukraine in terms of our supply side shocks, where goods are in short supply, that era of the world significantly affect the wheat supply, the grain supply, and so stuff like bread and biscuit, and these things are being significantly impacted. It also, because of Russia has a significant impact on the energy market in terms of gas and oil. I saw a report this morning which indicates the big impact that Russia and the confrontation between Russia and Ukraine is having on countries such as Germany. Germany is now moving to what they refer to as a second phase in their emergency response to their energy vulnerability, energy challenges. And so the expectation is that there is going to be an ongoing challenge around this idea of distress, of higher inflation, and certainly, more pointedly, increased costs of energy, which is a big one. I heard one commentator say yesterday that there's an expectation that gas per gallon may reach $10. I just hope that is not the case. But should that be the case, it's going to be really, really hard. We would have heard from the Deputy Prime Minister in the currency of this week that, look, we have done some things in the budget, and that is, again, 100% spot on. Because I believe in anticipation of some of the things which were coming down the pipe, and in a bid to kind of counterbalance some of the ravages of the inflation, there are a number of measures which were built into this year's budget, which would kind of save costs directly to, well, not directly. The expectation is that some savings would flow to the consumer. So there were a number of duties on items which were reduced, some 5% were reduced to zero, and so on and so forth. And the expectation is that those are going to, in the term he used, trickle to the consumer. Now, given that it's not a direct impact from source to consumer, you can expect that there's going to be some noise in there. some disturbances. So hopefully most of that benefit will flow to consumers, and that will help to alleviate. But the larger output of that conversation, the larger output of that statement is really that on the side of increasing costs as it relates to gas and oil, there's not much more the government can do, except for, as we see being proposed now in the United States by the Biden administration, to have some sort of a, you know, tax holiday on these goods. So reduce the tax on gas, reduce the tax on diesel, reduce the tax on oil. If there's a tax being paid by the electricity generating entity, BPL, and that would therefore then have a knock-on effect on the consumer in that it would cost you less. But the extent to which that is workable on a macro basis, on a overall basis, from a big picture basis and from the country, I think needs some careful consideration. Seriously. Because on one hand, because everything at the end of the day points to how large or how small the deficit is going to be, and how that will ultimately affect the country's credit worthiness, we have to be very, very careful. And I want to be careful here, right? I'm not trying to be anti-consumer. I am a consumer too. I want cheap gas. I want cheaper gas. I want cheaper electricity. But as part of this conversation, as part of this national conversation, we have to ask ourselves, are we willing to take a bit of the burden to make some adjustments to our lifestyle? Maybe we'll have to downgrade from cars to bicycles. Maybe we'll have to drive less. We'll have to make some adjustments. But are we willing to do that, or are we in a position where we will say to the government, you must do some things which is going to make life easier for us in this moment? And if that is done, I believe that we have to come to the recognition that there is a knock-on effect. We may not pay it today, but we will pay it further down the road. Because here is what I believe to be true. The Bahamas projected a deficit, I think, of about, it was maybe 7 or 8% for 2021, 2022. At least that was a projection that was done in the mid-year budget. And we came in better than that. It's projected that we are going to be at about 6%, which is positive. And when I say this is positive, I'm looking at this through the eyes of the lending market. So persons out there looking in on the Bahamas and saying, well, if we were to lend to them, what kind of trajectory, how are they performing? Well, they say they were going to do 8% and they came in better than that. So the deficit is smaller than we expected it to be. That's a positive. Additionally, the projected deficit for 2023 is going to be even smaller. At least it's projected to be smaller at 4%. And the subsequent years get smaller and smaller until I think we turn the deficit into a surplus in year 25, 26. Now, an analyst, a credit analyst looking at that, see those things as being beneficial because we are creating an improving circumstance. Remember, I said to you before that where we are right now is not very advantageous. Persons are demanding a premium. We have landed on this distress listing of countries because we are now paying, or persons, we have to pay a premium of 10% or more in order for persons to lend to us. So looking at it from that perspective, from that vantage point, through that lens, the extent to which we are reducing the deficit, and as I said to you earlier, revenue minus expenditure equal deficit or equal an addition to the loan. It's actually a loan, unless we're not going to fund it. And if we leave it unfunded, that means that next year we'll have to significantly reduce our expenditure, and that would affect the goods and service that government can provide or is willing to or is able to provide, and that's going to affect adversely our standard of living. So from the lender's perspective, if you are reducing deficit and then actually going into a surplus circumstances, then you have less need for debt. Your circumstances are becoming more, and therefore your capacity to borrow, or not to borrow so much in the first instance from them, but your capacity to repay the debt, the ones you have existing, and maybe anything else you may need in the short term, is better. And that for them is a positive. So to connect that to the point I was making earlier about asking the government for these reduction is simply this. The reduction in terms of taxes will ultimately or could ultimately result, because the government could make adjustments elsewhere, which would then have the effect of changing the quality and the quantity of services provided. But assume that nothing changes. That reduction will result in an increased deficit, larger than projected in the first instance. And that has its own messaging to the lending market. So we have to be careful. Yes, as citizens, as residents, we want to be in a situation, and the purpose, one of the main purposes of government is to, you know, look, take care of the well-being of the citizens. But there is a balance. And we have to be very, very mindful of that balance. I know in the Bahamas, when we talk about, you know, taxes or giving tax breaks and stuff, you know, it's always a very divisive type of a discussion. It always ending up to be. There's some persons who are hard on the side, don't increase the tax, always reduce taxes so that we can have things cheaper. But at the end of the day, we have to be mindful that we are not simply working with the circumstances that we would have had maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago. We are literally sitting on $11 billion in debt or thereabouts. It's expected to be at that level soon if it's not already there. We are sitting on that. That has to be repaid at some point in time. The government or the country, shouldn't say the government, but the country has perennially run deficits. And if you're running deficits perennially, it means that the debt that you currently have is going to increase, has increased almost every single year. And if that continues in the environment which we are, and under the circumstances of lenders demanding a premium of 10% or more on U.S. Treasury, then clearly the circumstances of the country is not going to improve. So my point is, at what stage do we pay more now or suffer a bit of squeeze now so that tomorrow can be better, so that the country may be in a position to better manage its debt going forward? I think that is a fundamental question for every single citizen and resident to ponder. Because it don't matter who you like and who you support and how you believe the debt got here. The debt now belongs to you and I and every single person who is a citizen in this country. And eventually it has to be paid off. And it's going to be paid off via taxes. That's the only way the government will be able to do that or sell some of its assets, which there's not a lot to go around these days. So which do you prefer? So I do understand that there are persons who are going through significant challenges. And again, if the government have to provide for, in terms of social services, that is kind of like, you know, taking from Peter and paying to Paul, you know, might as well you reduce the taxes. But if it is going to create a situation, if it is going to create a situation where the deficit is going to be significantly adversely impacted, we have to slow down, we have to pause, and we have to give serious consideration as to whether or not that's the road we want to go down. Why? Because continued at this level, continuing facing the type of debt circumstances that we are, and I do appreciate that we're going through, you know, extraneous times. It's unusual times. But we don't know when this is going to end. We don't know when the war in Ukraine is going to end. We don't know when we are going to tame inflation. We don't know whether the globe is going to get plunged into a recession. There are so many uncertainties out there. The thing that we can control on this side, we have to control. And the only point I'm making there is it might be foolhardy. It might be foolhardy. And I believe this is one of the reasons you see the administration is not rushing to do some of the things which has been called for. But it might be foolhardy to trouble too much the revenue side of this particular arrangement where we are right now. And create a circumstance, which sends a message to the credit market that the trajectory which is needed is going to be totally out of whack. We have to be very careful. We have to be very much mindful of that. What does all of that say? It says that we are in a place of concern. We are in a place. Not that, you know, you can't come back from this. We have seen other countries which have had significantly larger, huge issues compared to where the Bahamas is right now. But that is irrelevant because those countries have to take care of themselves and the Bahamas have to take care of itself. The point is that at this stage, it's not very advantageous. And the outlook for growth, for example, you see the projections for the Bahamas growing. So we were significantly down as a result of the combination of Dorian and the pandemic. We got that bounce. There is an additional bounce up maybe of about 8%. And then we are expected to revert to an average of 2% going into 2027. What does that mean? We're going back to a very low or slow rate of growth. And if we're growing at that low level, it's indicative of the fact that we may continue to run deficits. We may not be able to secure the type of surplus we need. And consequently, we may not be in the best position to start paying down this debt. And it's important. It's absolutely important for the country to resolve its debt situation. If you take a look at the administration debt strategy report or debt management strategy. The intent is to cut debt to GDP to 50% by 2031, I think. It certainly said 10 years. So I think that was written in 2021. So yes, in 10 years by 50%. What does that mean in simple mathematics term? Let's assume that at 2% or so growth, right? GDP is going to be maybe 16 or 17 billion dollars at the outside in 2031. So the government is saying, well, we do not want to have debt which is more than, say, about $9 billion by then. So we're currently at 11 now. So at least $2 billion will have to be paid out, paid off. And that requires growth. That requires money. But that $9 billion, in my calculation here, assumes that everything stops and hold firm in that no additional debt is being added. And that's not likely to be the case. So in order to get to this $9 billion, my number based on my growth rate, to get to this $9 billion in 10 years, we will have to be in a position to pay off $2 billion from the existing amount that we're faced with now. And of course, any new deficit which is realized over the next, so that would be, we're now at 2022, so in another 8 years or so. So over the next 8 years, yeah, any deficit which is created, we should also be in a position to pay those down and finance them in order to hit that 50% debt to GDP. That's not a very easy thing to do. It is going to be challenging. But that's the target. And that's a target we're working towards as a country. So again, that's another aspect, another element which you have to put or take into consideration as you deliberate. Because this is a message which has been sent to the credit market. And these things sometimes for you and I, they don't mean a lot. But to those persons, if you say that's where you're going, they're looking at how you're going to get there. Trajectory is absolutely, absolutely important for these analysis. And so we want to be able to take a good look at that and to see where the Bahamas is and how the Bahamas is going to extricate itself from this listing, as Bloomberg referred to it as the Trouble 10, but more broadly, a listing of distressed nations, which finds itself paying premium compared to the U.S. Treasury of around 3% or so, paying a premium of 10%, or as they put it, 1,000 basis points. Significant challenge. We're going to take a break here, and when we come back, we're going to continue the conversation. Or in this instance, since you're not shouting me yet, this monologue, but certainly I expect you to join me on the other side, 323-6232, 325-4316, and 325-4259, our text line, 422-4796. You're listening to The Essentials, The Reset. Don't move. Come right back.
Around the world, Cleveland Clinic is recognized as a leader in healthcare. Our team of experts relentlessly pursues the best for our patients. From groundbreaking cancer research to state-of-the-art heart surgery, life-saving innovations happen here every day. When it's time to travel for your health, it's time to travel to Cleveland Clinic, your destination for care. For every care in the world. To learn more, visit clevelandclinic.org/Caribbean.
Do you know you can get your business cards designed and printed for as low as 18 cents a card? If it's a poster you want, you can pay as little as $6 a square foot. If your print needs are short or long run, digital printing, wide format, or print consultation, call the best. Call Printmasters. Printmaster's goal is to provide its clients with the highest level of personal, professional service at an affordable price. Our state-of-the-art technology also makes working together efficient and easy. Laminations, business cards, flyers, posters, window and floor decals are just a few of the digitized print services offered at Printmaster's. Call 302-2361. 302-2361. 2361 or visit us at the Nassau Guardian Building in Oaksfield. Print with the best. Print with Printmasters.
For the best jerk in the Bahamas, you must have Balu's. Pork, fish, and chicken served with our delicious country-style sauce and authentic festivals. Balu's, Nassau East South. Call or WhatsApp 376-8951. Balu's, the jerk with the soul of reggae and the spirit of Junkanoo. Balu's jerk, traditional, slow-cooked to perfection. 376-8951. Get yours today.
The Access Accelerator Small Business Development Center is here to help small businesses throughout the entire Bahamas. To better serve you, we've made it easier to contact us. Call 461-7232, WhatsApp 359-0626 or 359-2394, email helpdesk@sbdcbahamas.com or submit a ticket when you visit our help center at accessaccelerator.org. The Access Accelerator, empowering small business.
This is Guardian Radio, 96.9 FM, Nassau, Bahamas.
And welcome back to The Essentials, The Reset. We just had an exploration, if you will, into information emerging that the Bahamas has found itself or been listed as one of the Bloomberg distressed nations. And so in discussing that, because, you know, it is what it is. We are where we are. What is more important is that we understand what the totality of the issues are, which, one, got us there, and two, what the criteria are for being there, and then, you know, being able to contemplate some of the larger issues which we need to confront in order to move from there. And I trust that that's what we were able to do just now in terms of going through those, looking at that, and really trying to tie the pure economic issues, you know, whether it's the debt or the interest rate or whatsoever it is, with some of the social considerations. Because ultimately, it comes down to what is the social impact on the individual citizen, on the individual resident, on the individual taxpayer at the end of the day? And I think I sought to make the argument that, yes, recognizing that the taxpayer need and deserve relief. And some of those relief is being confronted, especially in the areas of energy. And we saw recently a news article which suggests that there could be a cost of electricity. So that, too, will be another area of concern for the consumer, for the taxpayer. But while that is so, I also sought to make the point that let's be very careful. Let's be very, very careful. Here is my position. This is my personal position. I'm not trying to impose this on you or impose this on anybody. This is how I would go about my business. Confronted with a significant challenge, which has the potential of slowing down my future growth, slowing down my future opportunities, I would seek to spread the cost, recognizing that there is a cost to be paid for fixing whatsoever it is the problem I'm faced with. There's no way around it. There's a cost to be paid. My personal approach would be, I am going to start to take some now. Even though it may require some sacrifice, even though it may feel a little bit uncomfortable at this moment, I would not move wholesalely to shift from a point of ridding myself totally or significantly of the current discomfort, which is going to cause me problems in the long term. Because as you grapple with the issue of debt, time is currency, yeah? And as you move outward, it becomes a little bit more expensive. Whether it is by a quantitative assessment or a qualitative assessment, eventually it will translate into money and it will translate into increased taxes going back to pull some value from you, yours, and mine pocket. So my preference would be, let's start early to do the things which are necessary. And in this instant, it may be, the necessity may be, let's not rush to ask for significant amount of relief in this moment, because that have its own serious, potentially serious impact on the government numbers. And the extent to which the government numbers may not terminate at the end of this fiscal or going into the next fiscal, first quarter of the next fiscal, looking reasonably okay. And by okay, I mean consistent with projections. That could represent a problem for us. So let's take that in mind. And, you know, maybe, I am not necessarily qualified to say this. There are other persons who are in positions who would make this call. But maybe there is a moment, or a moment has arrived, for us to have a national think about how we as individuals will be called upon to contribute to making the future a little bit better. And that contribution may simply be, you know, we don't need to take any more money out of your pocket or anything like that. We just need you to kind of cope just a little bit more, a little bit longer, temporary, it might be, with some of the discomfort. Understand that, yes, you are uncomfortable. Understand that, yes, you are challenged. Understand that provisions will be made for those who are most vulnerable amongst us. But also understand that you have to give up something for a better tomorrow. So we can leave that one there. I want to make a switch to a document which is released by someone we know very well around this side of the world, Ms. Marla Dukeran. She has a Caribbean monthly economic report, and this is the one for June. And I want to go through the introduction, if you will, because there is a overview, and then she goes into talking about different countries. She talks about the Bahamas, Barbados, Cayman. She refers to Cuba, Dominican Republic, and Guyana, and also to Jamaica, Suriname, and Trinidad and Tobago, some of the bigger countries or the bigger economies within the Caribbean. But the overview says, diversifying into the knowledge economy, Cayman gets it right again. And I just believe, having read this, that it's instructive. It's useful for us to kind of go through this and see, because Cayman is obviously doing some great things. And why would Cayman be important in our discussion around national issues is because of the similarities. The Bahamas is different in many ways, a larger population, greater landmass, more islands, different population centers and so on and so forth. But there are similarities in the way that we make money as a nation and the way Cayman does. So I'm going to read through this and then make some comments on it. The Cayman Islands economy is driven mainly by the financial services sector and tourism, just as the Bahamas is, with the construction sector having the largest economic multiplier. The population of the Cayman Islands somewhat varies, reached roughly about 70,000 pre-pandemic, with a GDP per capita of $90,000. So the Bahamas have a GDP per capita of about 30,000+. Cayman is three times that. The population is 70,000. The Bahamas is 300,000 or 400,000. So, not even a quarter of the Bahamian population. So the overall unemployment rate was 3.5% in 2019. So they're doing extremely well, with roughly half the population classified as non-resident or work permit holders. So that's one of the uniqueness about Cayman. With a small population, they are able to have more non-resident workers in their population. That's their demographic. So in other words, job creation for Caymanians is not a major challenge in Cayman. The challenge is in creating a shift toward higher pay employment for residents supported by a knowledge-based economy. And that is exactly what Cayman Enterprise City, or CEC, has devoted the past 10 years to, demonstrating just how great a role the private sector can play in solving our socio-economic problems. So a lot has been said in those couple of lines, right? So first of all, even though Cayman doesn't have an unemployment problem like the Bahamas does, it does have a similar issue of being able to shift persons to higher paying endeavors, higher paying engagements. And then out of this emerged this initiative, the Cayman Enterprise City. And this has been going on now for 10 years. What is so important about this? I'm tempted to say unique, but I don't know enough about what exists elsewhere. But what is so important about this for me is that this is not a government-led initiative. I'm sure that the government is supporting it someplace there. I'm sure that there are concessions, and we see that as we go through the rest of this material. But what is important is that it is private sector led. Private sector led. I underline that because I believe that, especially where the Bahamas is right now, we talk a lot about PPP, private, public-private partnerships, and government working with private sector. But I really believe, and I'm convinced that the way forward for the Bahamas is for the private sector to become way more involved in development, in initiative that intersects at economic and social development. And this CEC, Cayman Enterprise City Initiative, seemed to be doing exactly that. It has been in play for 10 years. But for the most part, for a large part, it is not simply just about business. They are also focusing on how can we take citizens, how can we take individuals and upgrade them, get them to the level where they are now involved in higher value creating vocation, in higher value creating employment. And at the same time, we are solving a socioeconomic problem in that persons are now better employable, greater empowered. We are getting to the place where the country is going to be more productive and the productivity is going to grow higher. We are solving also a problem in that we are fixing social issues without having to incur public costs to the extent, at least directly. Incur public cost in that it's not the government which have to go into its pocket to fund a particular initiative. This is coming through the private sector. It's profit driven, and all things being equal, it's more effectively run than the public sector could. This is important. And so we see this CEC, City Enterprise City in Cayman. It's a privately run inward investment promotion agency. CEC recently celebrated 10 years since it welcomed its first special economic zone company to the Cayman Islands. So obviously, the government, as part of its support, has created a special economic zone, and I would suspect that in this economic zone you have, you know, it's like a free zone, maybe limited tax or no tax or tax holidays, or if you build in a particular area, obviously it's a maybe a geographical area. I've never seen it, I've never been there, so you know, we're just using our imagination here. But the government obviously is supporting it through giving concessions. But it is a profit-driven entity. Over the period, it has achieved an economic impact of $662 million. So over 10 years, it has created an economic impact of $662 million, over $500 million. That is significant. So after a decade of growth, it says, CEC has improved the competitiveness of the Cayman Island and is now home to the largest innovation ecosystem in the Caribbean. I think we have to pause and repeat that for emphasis. In the first instance, over 10 years, this private sector-driven initiative has created economic impact, not necessarily just, you know, money. You can't go and count out $662 million in cash. But the impact, as valued or measured by however they measured it, over 10 years has been $662 million. But importantly, it has helped to improve the competitiveness of the Cayman Islands. And it has also now created one of the largest innovation ecosystem in the region. That is fundamental. If after 10 years, this is what is being thrown off, imagine in year 20, in year 30, as it grows and expands. So I believe that an initiative such as this is instructive for the Bahamas. There have been any number of discussions around how we want to contemplate better using our concession regime. And this discussion has been on the table for many, many years. Many, many administrations. Well, at least multiple administrations. And it would seem as if, given our experience with providing, you know, special economic zone for in response to disasters, in response to challenges in the family island and so on and so forth, that this won't be something totally new to us. Certainly our experience with Freeport, which is essentially a type of a free zone, should put us in a position where there is national competency in dealing with this. Maybe Freeport is, or Grand Bahama, alongside Freeport, close to Freeport, maybe some competition would be good for the Hawksbill Creek Agreement. I don't know it that well, so maybe there's some clause in there which precludes that. But certainly, the creation of some sort of economic zone as contemplated here could be instructive for the country and could be beneficial in the long term. So as this continues, it says, importantly, CEC does not rely on government funding and is a purely private initiative. Additionally, CEC supports a strong economic and business framework and progressive ecosystem. A strong business framework and progressive ecosystem without posing additional administrative burden on government. So, without asking government for a single red cent, this entity, this initiative, is able to provide a strong economic base and also create a progressive economic system or ecosystem which see multiple types of organization, multiple types of business being developed, being nurtured within this particular zone, being attracted into the country. And that, I think, obviously is going to pay a dividend. Well, it's currently paying dividend, but certainly would pay additional dividend in the long run. So it hasn't put any additional burden on the government. In 2021, total revenues from the CEC amounted to $5.3 million, bringing the total since inception, that is from 2011 to 2021, to 23.17 million. So this is phenomenal. It's not big, huge numbers. It's $23 million over 10 years, basically. So that's working out to be about $2.3 million per year. But what is important in that, or what we should take away from that, is not so much that, you know, it's a small amount, but it's one, there is no burden on government, none at all. And two, there is actually benefit flowing to the national kitty, flowing into the treasury as a result of this initiative. So it's a positive, it's a win-win for the country. I believe, I don't know what the whole structure is, but if we are going to be rethinking the use of concessions, maybe this is one of those things which can be contemplated in that whole setup. It may or may not suit us, but it should at least be looked at because it seemed to have some attraction. It seemed to be beneficial. And as we go deeper, I will demonstrate to you how much more impactful this is likely to be in the coming years. So over the last decade, this has provided government revenues of $23.17 million. So the CEC reports its financial statements and economic impact annually. So maybe this is by arrangement with the government. So you have to not only tell us exactly how much you're making, put your revenues and expenses out there for the public so that there is full transparency, but there's obviously an economic impact study being done annually to determine how this is benefiting the public. And there's also annual public reporting since 2013 on how government concessions within the CEC, SEZ, that is the Special Economic Zone, members are deployed. So yes, that confirms the fact that the government is supporting it. The government is providing concessions within this zone. But importantly, very, very importantly, and this I think is very fundamental, because here in the Bahamas, we know that there is a significant amount of concession which is given out annually or over a long period of time. But how exactly is that being deployed? How exactly is it being used? How exactly is it benefiting the country? that aspect of it is not known. It's not as transparent and as clear. At least I don't remember hearing any report. I've never seen or heard any discussion in that regard. At the front end of a potential investment or a heads of agreement, you would hear about the concessions which have been given. But as the project develops, as the project comes to fruition, and as the business continues, you don't hear anything about the impact, the deployment, the use of this concession. And I think largely it's one of the reasons why you have heard so much being said from one administration to the next, because the whole concession apparatus itself, the way it plays out after it has been granted, appears to be somewhat opaque and fuzzy, not very, very clear. And so, you know, we've heard this, and I think it's the right direction of the thinking. It needs to be looked at. It needs to be addressed. And this, I think, presents maybe an example of how that could be used for benefit. The writing continues. Through its Enterprise Cayman initiative, which is now a standalone nonprofit, so maybe they have another entity associated with that, CEC is actively preparing the local workforce for industries of the future. CEC is actively preparing the local workforce for industries of the future, promoting lifelong learning and greater economic mobility. This is socio-economic or social economic development at its best, as long as the results are positive. But certainly this framework represents something which is fundamentally sound. Look what's happening here. They're taking the local workforce. If it was in the Bahamas, then you and I, and they're saying, hey, here are the industries of the future, whether it's going to be digital asset, cryptocurrency, it's going to be technology, it's going to be some high-tech era, whatsoever those are. They're taking individuals and they're preparing them for the future. Therefore, the country is likely to experience, once these things become crystallized, is likely to experience greater diversification. It's also likely to position its citizens, its residents, as it states here, to be more economically mobile. In other words, to lift persons up out of the socioeconomic level, socioeconomic standard that they are, wheresoever that is at the moment, and put them at a higher level. I think this would be useful for the Bahamas. I think this would be very instructive as we seek to move individuals out of poverty, move individuals well away from that poverty line, to get the country to a level where, you know, GDP per capita can grow, but in real terms, not just GDP per capita, but individuals are more economically and financially mobile. They have more money in their pockets. They can do more things. They're upwardly mobile. They can invest in education. They can invest in greater health care. They can invest in things which make them more productive citizens. They can get into entrepreneurial endeavors and so on and so forth. I think this is instructive. Enterprise Cayman has placed over 100 students in high-impact internship, working directly with industry professionals, while 10 scholarships that fully support tech careers in the Cayman Islands were awarded in 2021. 255 students and adults benefited from interactive workshops, mentorship, internship, and work placement through CEC in 2021. So the number of persons that happened last year. And it says here that CEC won Excellence Award for Environmental, Social, and Corporate Governance Practices by Financial Times, FDI Intelligence Magazine in 2021. So, not only is it being beneficial on the local scene, but it's also getting international attention. And that is also going to be a positive. That will augur well for the country by drawing attention to the initiatives which are on the ground. I am sure it may influence foreign direct investment decisions. It may influence persons who want to go and invest in the country. It may influence persons who want to, move their operations to the Cayman. Because one of the considerations is always going to be, if I'm starting a particular type of business, will I have the necessary resources? Is there sufficient, human capital there to support me in terms of me finding the employment that I need, the labor that I need in order to make this particular business successful? So having that type of very public but international exposure to receiving such an award, I think is a huge positive. So here we have a private sector initiative doing things which crosses the economic and socio-economic divide and preparing the country for the future. But here is where I think it makes the point. Here is where I believe it makes the point and become extremely instructive for the Bahamas. As we seek to grow the economy, as we seek to grapple with our debt circumstance, as we seek to unlock and diversify our economy, diversify away from financial services. I'm not saying we don't do financial services or we don't do tourism. Actually, we want to do more tourism. We want to do more financial services, but we want to do some other things so that when you look at the totality of an expanded economy, tourism and financial services, while they are bigger in absolute terms, they are smaller as a proportion of the economy than they are currently. That's kind of my definition of diversification. And the other things that we are going into will be receiving or creating foreign currency earnings. So it says here that the CEC is now home to over 280 special economic zone companies and features a wide variety of globally significant businesses, including, it has a wide variety of globally significant businesses, including, listen to this, blockchain development companies, some of the world's leading traders of virtual assets, three of the world's top 10 decentralized autonomous organizations, one of the world's fastest growing web browsers, a world-renowned video production company, and the planet's fastest growing precious metal royalties company. Advanced communications, biotechnology, artificial intelligence, virtual reality, and high-tech manufacturing are all examples of industries active at CEC. I just want us to pause there for a quick minute as we wind down to the end of the show. And listen to the entities, the businesses, the nature of the activities which these businesses are involved in a Cayman Enterprise City Special Economic Zone in the Cayman Islands, right here in the Caribbean, one of our Caribbean neighbors, that has an economy which is highly similar to our economy, but which does some things differently. And I think over the years have garnered significant success, especially in financial services, as a matter of fact, taking market share from the Bahamas. And I'm not pointing this out as a criticism. The point here is that what we have in front of us is instructive of what the Bahamas can do and what I believe should be contemplated. Because at the end of the day, we have to borrow ideas, good ideas. We should borrow good ideas from wherever we find them. And to the extent that there are going to be nuances and local things to be taken into consideration as it relates to Cayman. So I'm not proposing that we can wholesale import this into the Bahamas without any tweak. It's about adaptation for our own environment. But it is instructive that we have such similarities of economy. And they're doing this. And we are not. At least not in this format. At least not in a way which is private sector driven. At least not in a way which has demonstrated a significant economic impact to the tune of over $500 million. I think it would be useful for us to dive into this, to understand that with such a setup, we can attract entities that's into biotechnology, so more of our students can come back home to the Bahamas. Those are into artificial intelligence, which is the way of the world, the way of the future. Virtual reality, it is the future. High-tech manufacturing, maybe they're not actually manufacturing locally, but they are headquartered there. But however it is, there has to be benefit emerging as a result of their presence. You have virtual traders in virtual assets, world-renowned video production, and the planet's fastest-growing precious metal royalty company. So it is absolutely the best one in the world. They didn't even say world, they say the planet. On planet Earth, this is the absolute best one, and it's resident in Cayman. Whatsoever it is that they do there, but is resident in Cayman in this special economic zone. I believe that the Bahamas can replicate and do something like this much bigger. We have greater space. We have greater options. I think we have greater geopolitical advantages, greater proximity. There are much more things which are going for the Bahamas. Larger population size. A significantly larger diaspora out there which can help to support some of this. There's so much going for the Bahamas, which I believe that moving in this direction should be beneficial, could be beneficial, and maybe it should be one of these things which is on the table as we discuss, and we should be discussing actively, the total revamping, or at least some significant changes to the current concession regime that the country employs as it seeks to ramp up its foreign direct investment and support local investors. So the final part of this document says, one of the fundamental challenges we face in this region is that of irrelevant and bloated institutions. CEC is a perfect example of an institution created not by the government, but by the private sector, which contributes to broad socio-economic development, economic diversification, and growth in meaningful and lasting ways. So very, very important. Couple of quick terms. Broad socioeconomic development, economic diversification, and growth in meaningful and lasting ways. If those are words which do not drag your imagination and immediately impress upon you that they hold value for the Bahamas, socioeconomic development, economic diversification, and not just any old growth, any old development, but growth which is meaningful and lasting, in other words, sustainable growth. This is exactly, these are not my words, I'm reading from the document, this is exactly the kind of institution that every country in the Caribbean needs if we are to cement ourselves on a path of sustainable socio-economic progress. This is a document put out by Marla Dukeran's organization, and the conclusion which was drawn there, I would totally align myself with it. An organization such as that If it works as reflected here in this document, in this statement, I believe could be hugely valuable, could be a game changer for the Bahamas. I really think it's something which should be looked into. I really think it's something which should be on the table for serious consideration. And given the fact that it's just down the road from us, one of our neighbors, I believe that in the near future, maybe if that has not yet been done, that's one of the places that a tour should be led to. A group of persons should go to visit, to study, to ask questions, and to come back with a view of how this can be implemented for the Bahamas to be a better place. So on one hand, we talk about the loan, and we know that that don't sound all nice and rosy, and because there's some challenges there. But on the other hand, we are exploring an issue which presents for us significant opportunity. So it's never all doom and gloom. It's a question of how we go about fixing this country, confronting our challenges right up front and seriously, and then fixing the country for the long term so that we can create greater, more sustainable socio-economic development. And we're going to leave it there for this evening. And as usual, we like to say, do not ever allow your greatness to become a victim of your unwillingness to change. You have been listening to The Essentials, The Reset. Take care. COVID is not over, so walk good. Be careful. One love and Ubuntu. Good night. You know it's so essential, so serious.